Hello and welcome to the final episode of Livewire's Rules of Investing for 2017. Today we've got a special guest host, Livewire co-founder and managing director, Tom Mackay. He recently sat down with Nikki Shavak, partner and co-founder of Blackbird Ventures, one of Australia's most successful VC firms. They'll be discussing what makes a great startup founder and why it's so different from a public market CEO, his early days at Bookmark Box with Atlassian co-founder Mike Cannon-Brookes, and which company he thinks could be the most valuable in the world 10 years from now. I hope you enjoy.
Welcome to Livewire's Rules of Investing podcast. My name's Tom Mackay and I'm the founder and managing director of Livewire. Today I'm really excited to be joined by one of Australia's best known venture capitalists, Nikki Shavak. Nikki is the co-founder of Blackbird Ventures, a VC firm that likes to invest in startup and scale up businesses that are going after large global markets using innovative technologies. Nikki, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You've been involved in the startup scene now for 20 years. How did you first catch the startup bug?
I think it was when I was at university and there used to be two magazines that were published during that time of 98, 99, and they were Red Herring and The Industry Standard, if anyone remembers those publications. And at the time of 1999, there used to be almost like yellow pages thick of stories of entrepreneurs creating companies, and it was just so inspirational. And I think through reading that, became inspired to start my own entrepreneurial journey. And you know, this was when I was 18 at university, and sort of put the full-time university on the back burner. We didn't drop out. We sort of shifted it to nights and weekends while we're doing the startup. But created a startup in 1998 called the Bookmark Box, which was back then, if you remember, you had different computers at school and work and home. And this was a way for you to manage and share your bookmarks online, and it would sync up through all the computers that you ever used. And the company did well, but you know, probably the most famous part of the company was that the co-founder was Mike Cannon-Brookes. He and I were going to university together at the time and used to live together in the same house. That was really, I think my university education, I think I learned more through the sort of 18 months of the Bookmark Box than I did in my whole university degree. And then, you know, from that point on, knew that, you know, I wanted to work in technology, I wanted to work in startups, and eventually that took the form of becoming an investor in startups. But, you know, from that very first experience, knew that I'd found my calling.
And what sort of impact has Mike had on your career?
I mean, he has been instrumental at, you know, all levels of, you know, personal support, mental sparring partner, you know, inspiration through the journey of what he has created with Scott and the whole team at Atlassian over the last 17 years. You know, just every single business and personal aspect, you know, feel very honored to call him a good friend.
Is there any stories you can tell us about you and Mike and the things you got up to in the early days?
It wasn't so exciting. You know, I think Mike was a very different person back then. I think, you know, the only thing, he stayed very level-headed, but perhaps the only thing that has changed is his fashion sense. So he used to be a very, you know, buttoned up young man wearing his mobile phone on the outside of his pants and, you know, wearing a sort of a tie and blazer kind of fashion versus his, you know, unshaven hat wearing white t-shirt uniform of today. But, you know, it's still remarkable how, you know, level he has stayed through the last couple decades and, you know, what a great success he's been.
Yeah, absolutely. Nikki, I was interested to see that you started your career actually with Macquarie Bank. How was that experience? What did that teach you?
I don't know if it taught me a lot. It was definitely an introduction to the world of investing and how markets worked, you know, both emotionally and technically. The job was, working on a stockbroking desk for the private client division, so helping, with the client relations and updating them on their portfolios and how much they were worth and stocks that they might consider buying and selling and so on. I think, at all parts of life, it comes down to the people you get to work with. And, in that particular case, it was a lady who, was just a great person to learn from in my younger years of my career. And I guess, this dual track of I'd always been fascinated by investing and particularly by the great long-term investors like Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger in particular, and those who were just so fascinating to listen to about how they thought about the world and how they'd mapped out this system of how people interacted with each other in business. And that dual track of interest in technology startups, but also the fascination with the great investors of our time and how they thought about the world and understood it.
How did Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger shape the way that you invest today as a venture capitalist?
I think there's actually a lot more parallels than there's not. So the not is obviously early in Warren Buffett's career, he didn't want to pay. He wanted to pay very, very cheap prices. So the idea of the cigar butt of you pay 70 cents for a dollar and hope that gap changes. But I think that style, I don't think, has any analogies. I think the style that has the analogies is his sort of second phase of his career when he did team up with Charlie Munger, and all about looking for the best quality businesses in the world and paying a good price for them. So again, being very sort of price sensitive. Where venture capital and public market investing doesn't overlap, if you think about public markets, people are open to investing in any company at the right price. Whereas venture capital, people are obsessed about only investing in the right companies almost at any price. So this slight difference of anything being willing to be bought for the right price versus a handful of things out of thousands and willing to pay almost an unlimited price for those truly iconic companies. And then the similarities being venture capital, it's by requirement. You invest early on, you can't sell, it's completely illiquid. No one wants to buy a company that doesn't have scale in its business or is generating profits, opens up a new audience of people that might want to invest in you. So you can't really sell it if you want to sell it anyway in the beginning, but venture capital you hold for a very long time period. Usually if it's a success, you're holding for about 10 years. And again, with Warren and Charlie, that investment timeline of forever, I think, that's how you make truly great amounts of money. And then also, I think, when you have a timeline of forever, it really forces you to think about what are the truly great companies, what are the few companies that matter, which again, that sort of brings it back to the venture capital analogy of it's really about investing in, a few companies that matter. And, in the context of Silicon Valley, that might be a single company in every 7 to 8 years, the Uber, the Facebook, the Google, there's usually one every 7 to 8 years that nearly accounts for the entire returns of the industry, which again is another, difficult thing for people to wrap their minds around how uneven the distribution of returns is. It could be, a single company accounting for the majority of returns for an entire decade, which again, seems like an impossible thing.
So what are the characteristics of these truly great companies that you're looking for? And from experience with the winners that you've had, what are you looking for?
I think at the beginning, you're looking for people with incredible ambition who are doing their life's work. So it's probably much more about the people and how they bring that idea into the world in the beginning, and then over time it becomes much more about the business and the market, you know, how efficient the business can scale, the compounding effects of year after year of the service getting bigger and better, you know, attracting more users because it's bigger and better, you know, the network effects accumulating over time, you know, the strategic position, you know, the bigger it gets, the more unlikely someone is to try and create a competitor. So all of those things become more of a question of traditional investing. But I think in the beginning, you're looking for these quite strange people, like from the point of view that what public market investors might consider great management teams, in startup founders, you're not looking for any of that. You're looking for these sort of characters who look extremely unqualified in the beginning. And so if you think about all the biggest companies in the world, like Microsoft or Facebook, who had founders who didn't even finish university and were starting a company, or founders from companies like Google where they just finished university. And so you have these deeply unqualified founders and CEOs that become the greatest CEOs in the world, that become the Larry Pages or the Jeff Bezos or the Bill Gates or and so on. So you're not looking for resume level quality. You're looking for you know, these great insights into how the world should work but doesn't work, or these observations as to, you know, why the world is you know, working in an inefficient way, and it's time for a big leap forward, because all of these things have come to fruition. Usually that's like these technology trends that have been around for a while and people know that they're possible or that they exist, but at some point they just sort of get so cheap, and then you can re-examine why the world works in a certain way, and then those are the people that make it a leap forward. But then you know, as I said, that persistence or that determination, and you know, people who are doing their life's work, because usually it doesn't work out in the beginning, and the only way that they keep going, or the only fuel that spurs them on, is this great passion for doing it, rather than you know, just the financial motivation. I think people absolutely do it for financial motivation, but it's more like if I just solely focus my energy on solving the problem, all of these byproducts will spit out. I'll become really, really rich. I'll, you know, have a huge company. I'll, you know, make a huge impact in the world. But if I just focus on creating that great user experience, all of these other things happen. So you don't really focus on any of those other things. You just focus on the great user experience of whatever you're doing. And, you know, people who at the beginning of a startup, how do you assess if they're doing their life's work? And, you know, In the portfolio that we've been able to assemble at Blackbird, we're an investor in a company called Canva, where the founders, and in particular Melanie, who's the CEO, it was just so clear she was doing her life's work. She used to teach graphic design at university. She used to, previously her and Cliff founded a company called Fusion Books, which was a high school yearbook business that allowed schools, so teachers and students and parents, to create high school yearbooks and then pay for them and press publish. And then all the customers were using it for different things other than the yearbook, newsletters and all graphic design tasks. And then after that came Canva, where it was the sort of blank slate, you know, how can we fully solve this problem for the whole world? And so even before Canva, it was very clear that the founding team was just so passionate about solving and simplifying design for everyone around the world. And another example is a company called Safety Culture, which makes workplace safety. So very beautiful mobile apps that allow, you know, airports to do pre-flight checks, or construction sites to do safety checks, or you know, inspections of fire engines in the all across the US, or inspections of big assets like wind turbines and so on. And then the founder, Luke Anir, had previously been a workplace safety investigator, so he would come in and investigate when things had gone wrong on a workplace, on a work site, and again, and then began selling sort of workplace safety forms on the internet. So these kind of Word document templates, he would sell by marketing them through Google AdWords, and those are the two things he did before Safety Culture, the company that people know today. And so again, very clear that he was doing his life's work. So I think you look for that long-term orientation that someone who's on a mission to do something and they, evidence that, they've actually spent most of their life on that problem and so therefore are more likely to have that unique insight into how something might work differently.
Yeah, sure. So you're looking for visionaries who are good at problem solving, who are basically going after their life's work. I mean, what are the really big red flags that you see when you're seeing companies that just make you think straight away, no way?
Well, the opposite of life's work is an exit strategy. So someone who has an exit strategy at, the early days of a company, and then it might be, I'm going to sell to this specific company at this specific time for this specific price to two decimal places. And it's clear that if you have your eyes on the door at the beginning, you're not really concentrating on the right things. And so, that's a huge red flag. And then the other red flag is just, I think across society, this is true where, there are so many people with great ideas and so few that just actually go and do something, the filtering mechanism of actually going and doing something. So many people will erect these false barriers in their mind. I need to get a technical founder. I need to, raise capital. I need to do all these things. I need to build the perfect product before I launch. I need to, all of these false barriers prevent smart people from actually going and doing it. So you're looking for people with a huge bias for action. I would say the two things you're looking for are the two shits. So, why do they give a shit that life's work, that passion, that why do they care about the problem? And then can they get shit done? Do they just, sit around and complain, or they just go and do it? And again, that's surprisingly a huge filter for most of the world is people who talk about doing things and then people who go and do things. So you're looking for, again, the no excuses. Even when you do raise capital, it's not very large in relation to what you need to do. And it's a really unstructured environment. Even if someone does raise money, it doesn't improve things dramatically. It's still very messy. It's still very inadequate to finance something in which you would consider it normally achievable in a bigger company. It's those strange characters that can do that in that chaos with that little bit of money and that little bit of time and away they go.
So you're looking for the characters that can really get it done. Unlike many VCs out there, I know that you actually have an interest in listed company investing, and obviously you mentioned Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. What have your investments in private companies taught you that helps you to invest better in public markets?
We talked a little bit about what makes a great business and, Berkshire Hathaway being a pioneer in defining, what is a great business. And, if you thought about it and summed it up in one line, it would be you can raise prices and the customers don't blink. If you look at all the sources of competitive advantage on the internet, it's like extreme network effects. You can build these huge companies like Tencent or Facebook or what have you, and with extreme sort of lock-in because they're creating these networks that get stronger as they get bigger. The other thing I think people have missed over the last 20 years, so you think about 1999, people sort of had a few too many drinks and, in 2000 woke up with a hangover, but the hangover has lasted like 17 years such that, there's no public market anymore compared to what used to be a public market, in terms of companies that might be 6 or 7 years old and are growing very quickly but are unprofitable. And, they used to list on the public market. They used to have a welcome audience of people, and that has really shifted to companies staying private for so much longer. So you sort of, if you think about it as just a company and how old they are, you might have seen a company go public in year 7 of its life. Now you might see a company go public in year 11 or 12 of its life. And so, by that definition, the private markets or venture capital, the opportunity doubled in terms of time and then, probably 10x'd in terms of the amount of capital, because obviously as a company succeeds, it raises more and more money. So those rounds that are raised between kind of year 7 and year 12 of a company are much, much larger than in the beginning where it's like a few million dollars. It might be hundreds of millions of dollars in the case of Uber. It's doing a $10 billion round at the moment, and that was a public company 20 years ago, or even 10 years ago. Airbnb, it's a profitable, fast-growing, $3 billion in revenue company that's still private. Like, you know, people underestimate just to what degree the public market has decayed or disappeared. The job of venture capital or the surface area of venture capital just exploded so much because of that. And so it's almost like if you can't understand public companies, because venture capital's role has grown in those additional years, you can't really do your job without understanding the context of the public market. And then, things aren't different. Like, you know, it's not like a company one day before the public market, when it's private and has venture capital ownership, the next day when it's public, suddenly you don't know anything. Like, you imagine the logic of you invest in a company in year one, you hold it for 7 or 8 years, you get to know the founders, how they operate the company, you get to know the market, how good it is, you follow the progress of the business for 7 years, and then the company reaches a scale where it would have a welcome audience on the public markets. Company appoints an investment banker, they do some roadshows in some nice hotels, and someone from the small cap team comes along and sees the founder present and might get a 15-minute session in some room, and it's this honeymoon kind of, how much you want to buy in a week's worth of exposure to the company. And that person right then at that moment in time is an expert, and the person who's owned the stock for 7 years is unqualified, that's not your realm anymore. That doesn't make sense that you know about the company because it's listed on the public market. Like, that fundamentally doesn't matter to me. And it's fundamentally this kind of top-down view of the world. To take it a step further, that small cap person who invests in the company, keeps on doing well, the company does so well, it grows so large that the small cap person who's followed it for 5 years and owned it for 5 years can't own it anymore and is not qualified to own it because it went over some arbitrary amount of market cap such that it's now the large cap fund guy's realm of, and he's the expert, and the other person who is in the small cap team is deeply unqualified to invest in it now because it's just worth $1 more than it was yesterday. So I think, the financial markets are really configured in this top-down way that doesn't make any logical sense. I think, what makes sense is that you understand types of companies and how they grow, and types of founders and management teams, and areas of technology, whether that be like business software or whether that's robotics or whether that's whatever area of the world. I think you can be an expert on certain types of businesses, but I don't think you can be an expert on certain sizes of companies. That doesn't make sense to me.
So what are you really excited about and expert in at the moment in terms of the big sort of themes and ideas that are out there, Nicky?
I think Blackbird started with one insight, which was we love business software companies that are started by Australians that sell all around the world from day one. So even though the company's in Australia, the customers are all around the world, and they might not know or care that the company is in Australia. And that in the beginning years of Blackbird, which was in 2012, led us to Canva and Safety Culture and Culture Amp and Autopilot and Bug Crowd and all of these wonderful companies that were started by Australians who were trying to be the best in the world. So that theme has played out over the last 5 years. I think more recently, people are excited about AI at a high level, but are missing sort of how great companies are created. And so, the best example of AI for me is autonomous vehicles or cars that drive themselves, and that's an application of AI. AI's got to the stage now where it's so dirt cheap that computers can basically process imagery and video, as well as computers processing text, and driving a car is processing the world around you and determining who's a cyclist, who's another car, who's another truck, should you accelerate, should you put the brake on, should you turn right, should you turn left. And so autonomous vehicles is an AI, an expression of AI, But that's that. Even that's not enough. You need, you know, people to then take that vision to say, how could the world work a little differently? And we're an investor in a company called Zooks that is founded by a guy called Tim Kentley-Clay, who's the co-founder and CEO, and Jesse Levinson. And Tim was from Melbourne, now lives in California. And the idea of Zooks is basically an Uber-like service, but the cars don't look like cars. They look like a living room on wheels, and the cars don't have drivers in them, and you don't buy a car, you lease the vehicle, you know, pull out your phone, launch the app, take the vehicle from this meeting to the next meeting. And you know, because there's not a driver in the car, you can make it really cheap. And if you make it really cheap, at some point financially doesn't make sense to own a car. It just makes sense to pull out your phone and press a button and hail whatever kind of vehicle you want to have come and pick you up in a couple minutes. And so you know, not only do you need to sort of spot the technology trends where they're applicable, but you know, own that entire sort of customer experience. So I would say you know, driverless cars, if you had to generalize things, would come under the heading of robotics now. So looking at you know, what tasks and areas robots can have a chance at sort of really, you know, taking a leap forward in changing the world, you know, driverless cars being the best. But I think you know, software diagnosing medical conditions is another huge area that's of interest, and you know, the sort of list goes on. But I'd say if there's two insights of Blackbird, one is that business software sold all around the world from day one, and then you know, probably more recently that sort of robotics AI angle to a number of the companies. A
couple of quick ones to finish, Nicky. If we fast forward 10 years, what's the most valuable tech company in the world?
It's more most likely some company we don't know. If it were for the universe of companies that we do know, I think Amazon in particular has an ambition on no other scale that I've seen. And even if people think of Amazon as retail and groceries and you know, TV production to get people to subscribe to the Prime service and so on, I would even say in 10 years that will be in that whole public perception of Amazon will be just in a little other category in their financial statements, and everything will be in Amazon Web Services. I think people really underestimate how much of the internet is runs through AWS, and people think of it as these kind of cheap servers that you rent out hardware, and have underestimated how much Amazon has moved up the software stack, how much you know, companies and startups use Amazon's you know, proprietary or unique database software, or all of their software infrastructure services, such that, you know, not a lot of people are going to migrate off. Like Amazon will have complete lock-in of nearly all computing in the world, which, you know, I think is going to be proven to be the biggest market in the world, such that, you know, you could see it being worth 5 or 10 trillion, like, you know, that scale of possibility. Not saying it's likely, but you know, I think the world's most valuable company will be the company that will be formerly known as Amazon and renamed to, you know, AWS to reflect where all the money will be made.
Very good. And which big names do you think will be out of business or won't have evolved as fast as everyone thought it would?
I think all the car manufacturers, including Tesla, to be controversial, will no longer exist. I think you'll have all of the automotive world move into a service industry where you will have fleet operators, and I think most of the car companies will go away, or they will be sort of relegated down the value chain. They'll be the telco to the Google or the Facebook, and capture just a little piece of the pie when the great piece of the pie will be gobbled up by the consumer service offering.
Well, on that incredible nugget of information, Nicky Shavack, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, that's it from us for the year. We'll be back in January with more Rules of Investing. In the meantime, please follow us on Twitter at LiveWire Markets, visit our website, livewiremarkets.com, and subscribe to us on SoundCloud or iTunes. We wish you all a happy and safe holiday period, and as always, thanks for listening.